I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of HCP Live. Welcome to Doc Talk. This is the week of the American Society of Hematology annual meeting, being hosted virtually in its usual time slot of early December. ASH's annual occurrence near the very end of the year is generally a nice touchpoint for an agenda which reflects fledgling innovative research mixed with major clinical breakthroughs for severely in-need patient populations. Gene therapy proposals, phase 3 myeloma treatment findings, I mean, our own coverage this year reflects its generation of bookends, both exciting new topics for the next year of hematology, and the reaching of goals set in the years past. But today's highlighted interview from our ASH coverage comes from a group and its agent in the very middle of its clinical development. Global Blood Therapeutics and its drug Voxelotor, an FDA-approved deoxygenated sickle cell hemoglobin polymerization inhibitor for the treatment of sickle cell disease, presented on first-time long-term data from the Phase 3 HOPE study, in which the therapy was assessed over 72 weeks for benefit of symptoms, morbidity, and mortality in real-world patients with sickle cell disease. With sickle cell therapeutics serving as a major topic of ASH's annual meeting Traits of Innovation and Persistence, we sat down with a member of the Voxelotor team to discuss the aptly named HOPE study data. Dr. Elliot Vachinsky of the University of California, San Francisco, joined DocTalk to touch on the Phase 3 trial, the growing portfolio of Voxelotor, and current affairs in sickle cell care. We hope you enjoy.
All right. So, Dr. Vachinsky, obviously, we have a lot to discuss on the front of just advancing, the forms of care and assessment for treating sickle cell disease and how Voxelotor new data pertains to that. But first and foremost, with this centering around the discussion of new ASH trial data being presented for the Phase 3 HOPE study program, maybe we could just start there, if you don't mind. Can you sort of set the table for us in terms of exactly what is the trial makeup that is being presented here? What was the intent of the assessments, and what was the patient population?
Sure, thank you. Well, this is a multi-center randomized trial, really a significant undertaking that was designed to determine whether this drug, Voxelotor, can meet its primary endpoint, which is a rise in the hemoglobin greater than 1 gram. And it involved three arms at a 1500, 900 milligram dose of drug and a placebo arm in a 1:1:1 ratio of 90-90-90. And then they were followed for 72 weeks or more to determine if they met that outcome and importantly, if it was safe. This is a unique study in that, in my opinion, I think the only study so far that's been done in which the primary endpoint really addresses not just pain. Pain is a very descriptive single event. Scientifically, low hemoglobin is a core pathologic mechanism for morbidity and end organ failure and death. It correlates strongly with stroke, neurocognitive function, renal disease, pulmonary hypertension, a lot of things. And this is really the first real study that is looking at something beyond just counting pain events. So I think it's going to open the door to more therapy and better outcomes for sickle cell disease.
Excellent to hear, and obviously a hugely unmet need, correct? So maybe it also helps to foundationally discuss Voxelotor as an agent for sickle cell disease, if you don't mind, Dr. Vachinsky.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm really been around a long time and committed to sickle cell disease, and I was really young. One of the first therapies that came out in the early 70s and 60s was cyanate. They thought it cured sickle cell. And then there's been a series of other drugs. All of them, these drugs were aimed and improving outcome by changing the oxygen affinity of sickle cell disease. And they weren't successful, but the goal was to allow the sickle molecules to not, during deoxygenation, not to come close together in sickles. So basically, sickle cells, when if you increase the oxygen affinity, basically what that means is the red cell, the hemoglobin, holds on to somewhat more oxygen. And if there's more oxygen held on into the hemoglobin, there's a much lower rate that the cell will sickle. Unfortunately, sickle cells themselves, the hemoglobin, has a oxygen that's shifted in the other direction that makes the cell more prone to sickling or forming these rigid polymers that really destroy the cell. They're not normal, the oxygen affinity. This is important because by doing this, even in when the cells go through their cycle and into veins in which they're deoxygenated, and that's really where the deoxygenation really is a catalyst, data strongly has shown that they won't sickle. In fact, this is a primary mechanism for the fetal hemoglobin. As you know, when the fetus is in the mother, there's no real way that the fetus can breathe. So the way that a fetus gets oxygen is by having a special hemoglobin that has a higher oxygen affinity, hemoglobin F. And that what it means, that sucks the oxygen from the mom's red cells and enables the fetus to live. When sickle cell babies are born, they're asymptomatic, and in large part because of this elevated fetal hemoglobin that maintains the cell's health, in large part because of the increased oxygen affinity. So this drug sort of mimics that mechanism. Rather than increasing fetal hemoglobin, it alters the oxygen affinity. It's been tried in other ways, but this is the first drug that's actually been successful in the therapeutic range, in a range that's safe in terms of how far it shifts it, and in terms of efficacious in the health of the cell. Outside of this study, there's been a lot of papers already published on showing that the cells that have been come from people treated with this drug are healthier. They have an increased deformability, which means they can change their shape and easily go through a red cell. They don't break apart as easy. Metabolic functionings intracellularly are healthier. And so there's strong evidence before this that the cells are better and healthier. And what's more important, what's equally important, rather than just raising the hemoglobin, is that this rise in hemoglobin in these patients is not due to just pushing out more red cells like you would see with erythropoietin as a driving force. The reason the hemoglobin goes up is because the cells live longer, and therefore they are they don't need that kind of boost. In fact, overall, the erythropoietin drive is the same or significantly lower than they would before they started the drug. So the cells live longer, and therefore the hemoglobin goes up. And when you measure a critical secondary outcome, which is hemolysis, so when red cells fall apart, they release a large number of chemicals or proteins that really in themselves stimulate a cascade of inflammatory and thrombotic events. And so when hemolysis in itself, outside of just hemolysis, a high retic count, elevated LDH, more exposure to broken cells with phosphatidylserine, when this happens, the sickle, this stimulates thrombosis and inflammation, which is key cornerstone problems in sickle cell disease. And so when you have less hemolysis, you really have less other problems. In particular, hemolysis in itself strongly correlates with complications like pulmonary hypertension and other medical. So in addition to the benefits of raising your hemoglobin, which is really important in terms of the complications I mentioned, as well as quality of life, it gets at another key factor, the decrease in hemolysis. And hemolysis leads to a deficiency of nitric oxide. The broken down heme binds nitric oxide, which is a extremely important vasodilator that we all have. And when you're deficient in nitric oxide, you have vasoconstriction and many of the problems that that aggravate pulmonary and renal and other organ flow. So by decreasing hemolysis, you will have improvement in vasodilation from a secondary effect of less depletion of nitric oxide. So from a physiologic standpoint, the drug will elevate the hemoglobin. And I don't know if you've ever been anemic, but if you're running, if you're anemic, you have fatigue, you have decreased neurocognitive function, you do worse on IQ testing and performance studies, and basically many of the quality of life things, such as how far you walk and exercise and thinking skills are delayed or decreased. And those were some of the things that, for instance, erythropoietin was used in for other diseases. So you'll get that benefit. And I would expect over time that we will see the long-term benefit of this drug, which I believe will be a decrease in end organ failure. One of the problems with studies for the FDA or the NIH is a very short-term study period, and they're expensive. So to understand the long-term benefits of a drug that may be change the natural history of the disease, it's hard because you have to follow patients for a very long time. That's costly, and therefore you try to aim for short-term outcome measures that you can statistically report to meet for FDA approval. I'll shut up in a minute, but I was one of the co-investigators and authors of the first MCH paper, which was the breakthrough study that was done in 95 and led to approval in 98 of hydroxyurea for the treatment of sickle cell patients who had pain. And that study showed that the drug was quite effective in lowering pain rates in those who received the drug. We're all excited about really trying to find the long-term benefits of the drug, but the second part of the trial, which was long-term follow-up in a prospective way, we were unable to secure long-term funding for. And so the long-term funding for that was never really secured in a science way. And we've been working for years trying to extrapolate from the existing data and analysis its long-term benefit. So my feelings are this drug has met its short-term its goals by elevating hemoglobin and decreasing hemolysis. But emotionally, I believe when we follow these patients 10 years from now, we'll be able to see a significant change in the end organ failure and serious rates of neurocognitive renal failure and other kinds of life-threatening events.
Thank you for that, Dr. Fuchinski. I mean, that's incredibly comprehensive and with the historical context really lays out, I guess, the blueprint of what exactly Voxelotor could mean as, I guess, a game-changing therapy, correct? I mean, when we're looking at this generally in my mind, speaking very broadly at an entry level of, covering spaces where conditions that have had little to no success finally found a therapy that does make that breakthrough and begins to report long-term data and then begins to hit endpoints outside of its original primary efficacy. We're talking about something that's going to kind of shift the paradigm of potential care.
Correct? I hope so. I think that I believe, frankly, as an oncology person too, that sickle cell is a complex disease, and ultimately, I do believe that in the end run, to really, we will be able to minimize the morbidity of the disease with drug therapy, but it may take combination therapy in which the drugs act at different target points. And so, like leukemia, for instance, you need multiple drugs and you really lower and cure people. I think this drug in itself will have a significant benefit to patients as a single drug, but ultimately, I believe combination therapy will match or the risk-benefit ratios for those few patients or those patients who are eligible for a cellular therapy. And when we look into the future and you have to randomize and you have to treat people, you need to evaluate risk and benefit. And I do believe the advances in targeted therapy when integrated will have such an effect that they may enable patients to avoid really invasive therapeutic treatments.
That's excellent. That's great to hear. And just tying back over to this phase three HOPE study program being presented at ASH, and just the key takeaways that we have to share for clinicians who may be tasked. I mean, obviously, there's a lot, but if there's anything broadly speaking, touch
on. Well, there are two or three straightforward points.
Yeah.
The drug was remarkable in raising the hemoglobin. And so almost all the patients on the standardized dose of 1,500 milligrams reached the primary endpoint of greater than a gram rise in the hemoglobin. And over such a long period of time, a lot of drugs that have been tried in sickle cell, they report the peak and not the long-term average.
Right.
90% of the patients in this trial at the 72-week reached this point of 1 gram. And a significant percentage, I believe it was 60%, had a 2 gram rise over the period. Now, we're talking real increases in hemoglobin. And actually 20% or so had a 3 gram rise in hemoglobin. We're talking, therefore, about patients who have these kind of responses will be approaching, most of them will have hemoglobins of 10 or around 10 or even greater, which is really changing will change, in my opinion, over time, the clinical phenotype of the disease. With that much hemoglobin around that's healthy, growth and other things will improve. And a lot of the, so this isn't, a small amount. You know, the mean amount of increase with hydroxyurea in the initial trials was like 0.8 or 0.7 or less. So these are real changes in hemoglobin. So the drug clearly raises the hemoglobin over a long-term duration. The other thing that I, in terms of the hemoglobin change that I think is remarkable is that the higher the hemoglobin, the less pain they had. And this is an important concept because many people are worried about increasing the viscosity of the blood by raising the hemoglobin in sickle cell disease. And that's a reasonable concern. If you raise the hemoglobin in sickle cell patients without making the cells healthy, they are at risk for increased viscosity complications compared to normal people raising the hemoglobin. But what this study has shown that because you make the cells healthier, you can raise the hemoglobin without those problems. And in fact, this study showed the higher the hemoglobin, the less pain events you have. And I would imagine over time, the same relationship will exist with other organ dysfunction. In the STOP study, which I was an author of, in which we looked at transfusion to prevent stroke in sickle cell disease using a transcranial Doppler. We found that the patients with the higher hemoglobin group were the most protected. So this study changes the creates an environment that actually the medical community is going to need to rethink the thermostat that you use to looked at with how high the hemoglobin should go in patients who are, in patients who are making healthy cells. And the maximal hemoglobin that has been used based on anecdotal concerns and conservatively was 10. And that was really based on transfusion data. But actually this data to me suggests that we really need to, the benefit of this drug will be greater when you get more rise in hemoglobin and not, and so that is an important concept in its use. And so, and the secondary part of this, so it met its primary outcome of raising the hemoglobin, and it did it in a clinically significant amount over an extended period of time. And secondarily, the drug was safe in the study. It didn't really show any serious risk factors or metabolic or organ problems that one needed to be black boxed or worried about. And there were no events that suggested the shift in oxygen affinity, which is relatively mild, was related to caused any problems. So it has a good safety profile in the outcome. And so, and it's oral once a day. So I think raising the hemoglobin and a good safety profile and showing that higher hemoglobin patients do better are probably three key points of this study.
That's excellent. That's excellent news. And thank you so much, Dr. Fichinski. I wasn't sure if you had anything else to add. I apologize. I am double booked on meetings today.
I appreciate the chance to talk to you. I mean, I take care of a lot of people with sickle cell disease, and it's a morbid disease, and access to care is a huge problem. I believe that I'm really looking at methods and therapies that can be assimilated into their daily life effectively. Mm-hmm. And I run a program that does cellular and gene therapy and other things. And I really think when you're looking at patients around the world, and even in this country, unfortunately, you're looking at patients who really don't have access to care. And if we're able to improve access and offer an oral medication, we can make a difference around the world. There are probably 450,000 births a year of sickle cell disease in the world, millions of patients. And we really need to develop therapies that can be distributed and used in multiple settings in which the monitoring and the safety profile enables it to reach patients, not just in the United States, but worldwide. So this study was done in many countries and which really were incredibly active in collecting and monitoring. And it demonstrates the potential to change the disease, not only here in the United States.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's huge. It's really great to see this. So excited to see everything that's going to develop with it going forward, and excited to discuss a little bit more during ASH this weekend. So thank you so much for sort of a preamble into everything going in here and all the contextualization behind it, where we've been and where we're headed because of it. So
there's one other point I left out, which is really this study did not restrict patients who were already on hydroxyurea, which is FDA approved. And and what it showed was in patients who were on or off hydroxyurea, it still had its benefits. So even in patients who were on hydroxyurea, they had additional improvement in their hemoglobin and outcomes. So it's an additive or synergistic effect to the hydroxyurea patients. It isn't one or the other.
Right. Wow, that's excellent. That's excellent. Yeah, that's hope for everyone, right? So, yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks again to Dr. Fichinski for his time and perspective into this topic of sickle cell disease. And for more ASH 2020 coverage, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com. For now, I'm Kevin Kunzman. Thanks for listening to Doc Talk.